It's Wednesday, December 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up, the White House said today that U.S. troops in Syria have begun withdrawing. Complex preparations are underway for the release of Yemeni prisoners. And the White House signaled today it would consider a stopgap spending plan to avert a partial government shutdown at midnight on Friday. It's all ahead. The White House said today that U.S. troops in Syria have begun withdrawing shortly after President Donald Trump said that the U.S. has defeated Islamic State in Syria. The White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders said in a statement, "We have started returning United States troops home as we transition to the next phase of this campaign." Sanders said the defeat does not mean the military campaign by coalition forces is ending. A withdrawal of the troops would mark a sudden reversal in U.S. military strategy in the region. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and other senior U.S. officials have been advocating for a longer-term military presence in Syria to help ensure it cannot reemerge as a force in the Middle East. The U.S. has about 2,000 troops in Syria, many of whom work closely with an alliance of Kurdish and Arab militias known as the Syrian Democratic Forces. Well, National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden joins me here in the studio with a just-received statement from the Pentagon. Thank you for joining me, Jeff. What do you have there?
That's right, Kim. Just a few minutes ago, we got a statement from the chief Pentagon spokesperson, Dana White, and this is what it says. She says in the statement, quote, "The coalition has liberated the ISIS-held territory, but the campaign against ISIS is not over." She continues, "We have started the process of returning U.S. troops home from Syria as we transition to the next phase of the campaign." And she also says, "We will continue working with our partners and allies to defeat ISIS wherever it operates." This is, in some ways, a stunning statement, both from the president and now from the Pentagon about the defeat of ISIS. Just last week, the special envoy dealing with the Islamic State, Brett McGurk at the State Department, was talking about how still, as of last week, ISIS held 2% of its original caliphate, a pocket of territory in Syria in the middle Euphrates River Valley, with much of the fighting there concentrated in a town called Hajin in Deir Ezzor province, where he described ISIS had the hardest of the hard, the most dedicated, the most lethal of its fighters hiding in caves, in tunnels, putting up strong resistance to the bombardment by the coalition and U.S. forces from the air, and also from the U.S. partner forces on the ground, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, made up mainly of Kurdish fighters. And we've had Pentagon officials, military officials, and even Mr. McGurk himself talk about how they envisioned the fight to liberate that last remnant of the self-declared caliphate would likely take months, not weeks. Yet a week later, after about another 200 airstrikes, we have the Pentagon now and the president saying that ISIS has been defeated in Syria.
Now, some officials are saying that this really is not such a stunning thing coming from the president, because this is something that he said he was going to do when he was running for president. So what is the reaction to that?
Well, this is really interesting, because the president at one point before this had made clear that he wanted to bring U.S. troops home from Syria, and essentially Pentagon officials, including Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, talked him out of it, explaining from the Pentagon's point of view the need for a U.S. presence in Syria and also in Iraq, because there are considerable remnants of ISIS. While ISIS does not hold territory anymore, according to the U.S., it still has a good number of fighters, a good number of cells that have been hiding themselves throughout Iraq and Syria, ready to take action, ready to form quite a lethal insurgency. And the way to make sure that ISIS remains defeated is to make sure partner forces have that help. Without the U.S. forces there helping partner forces, what happens to that? The other reason that people are asking questions right now is that of the two stated purposes that the administration has given for being in Syria, one is to defeat ISIS. The other one has been to contain Iran. And there have been arguments from members of the administration that the U.S. needs a presence in Syria because Iran has itself a huge presence. They have tens of thousands of militia fighters. They have close ties with the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And so what type of message does it send, pulling U.S. troops out and beginning to pull U.S. troops out now of Syria to the Iranians when the administration has made clear that Iran is the biggest state threat in the region of the Middle East and has even talked about how Iran is a threat beyond the region? So what message does that send? How does the administration now counter Iran and their efforts in Syria without any U.S. presence on the ground?
Also, another concern, this comes as Turkey is saying it is preparing to launch an operation against a U.S.-backed Kurdish militia in northern Syria. So this is something that risks confrontation with the U.S. So where does this tie into that?
This has been a long-running bone of contention between the U.S. and Turkey because for the longest time, the most reliable fighters on the ground to push back against Islamic State, both in Iraq and especially in Syria, have been Kurdish fighters aligned mostly with the YPG, a group that is affiliated with the PKK, which is considered by Turkey and other Western powers, including the U.S., to be a terrorist group. And so Turkey has very much been worried about U.S. support for these Kurdish fighters, whom they see Turkey sees as a threat because of their connections, their close connections with the PKK in Turkey. And so the U.S. has for a while been trying to walk this fine line of explaining how the support for the Syrian Democratic Forces, which has many of these Kurdish YPG fighters, is essential, but at the same time telling Turkey, don't worry, the U.S. understands your concerns, the U.S. is your ally, and is not trying to do anything to support a terrorist group that's committed to making things difficult for Turkey. And it's been very difficult. Just the other week, the Pentagon announced that they were setting up observation posts that would be manned by U.S. forces in northeast Syria to make sure that, to keep both sides apart, to make sure that that Turkey understood that they weren't going to come under any threat from the Kurdish fighters who were working with the U.S. against ISIS. And many saw it also as a sign that the Kurdish fighters could say they don't have to worry about Turkey going against them. One of the reasons that the fight against ISIS in this part of Syria was delayed is several months ago when Turkey did make a move against some of the U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters who were fighting ISIS. The Kurdish fighters who were engaged with ISIS withdrew to support their fellow fighters who were now taking on Turkey. And so that delayed the campaign. So there are lots of questions. There are a lot of geopolitical ramifications. And from a bigger picture point of view, the Pentagon's own numbers that were released to an Inspector General report that was published in August estimated at that time, despite the fact that ISIS had lost 98% of the territory it once held in Iraq and Syria, that ISIS as a whole still was thought to have anywhere from 28,000 to 32,000 fighters in Iraq and in Syria, roughly split between the two countries. So even if the physical caliphate is now gone, as the Pentagon is saying and as the president is saying, what is the strategy and how do you work with partner forces when you have such a large contingent of ISIS fighters who are hiding, who are probably foreign fighters and could cause a lot of damage? Iraqi officials have been voicing concerns about that, and Kurdish officials in Iraq have voiced many concerns about that as well.
And just real quickly, I guess they're not going to pull out all of the troops. There will be some there remaining. Are those going to go after that stronghold that is still there?
Well, it's hard to know. The statement, again, that we just got from the Pentagon says that the coalition has liberated the ISIS-held territory, which would seem to be a reference to that 2% of territory around the town of Hajin where the remnants of the physical caliphate, the ISIS fighters, were putting up a very tough fight. So it would seem to be that that part of the equation, according to the Pentagon and the president, has been solved. There is no more physical caliphate, according to these statements. But still, as the Pentagon acknowledges, other officials have acknowledged that just once the physical caliphate has been eradicated, it does not mean the fight is over. And what a lot of people are looking for right now are more specifics on how that fight to make sure that ISIS does not reemerge and does not rebuild. How does that continue?
Okay, we'll just have to keep following these very interesting developments. Thank you so much. That's VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden here in the studio with me. Here are some of the top stories trending. The New York Times reports that hackers gained access to EU diplomatic communications networks for 3 years, allowing them to download thousands of sensitive cables. The U.S. and the Taliban conclude 2 days of marathon peace talks in the United Arab Emirates, promising to meet again for another round to complete the Afghanistan reconciliation process. Russian President Vladimir Putin boasts that his country's newest military weapon has no match in the hands of a foreign country. And the U.S. lawmaker leading a congressional delegation to several of the last places a Guatemalan girl was alive while in federal custody calls for the head of the U.S. Border Protection Agency to resign. Well, expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The International Astronomy Union's Minor Planet Center recently announced the discovery of 2018 VG18, the most distant object to be observed in our solar system. A team of astronomers say they spotted a dwarf planet they nicknamed Far Out that is some 100 times the distance between Earth and the Sun, which is almost 18 billion kilometers away from us. The discovery also marked the first time an object more than 100 times the Earth-Sun distance had been spotted. The astronomers say the object's brightness suggests it's about 500 kilometers wide and has a pinkish hue, a color scientists have found to be associated with icy objects. The team says the discovery was made while they were continuing their search for the so far unseen Planet 9. About 4 years ago, scientists found evidence of a giant planet in the far reaches of the solar system. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the VOA. I'm Kim Lewis. Coming up, a federal judge delays sentencing for former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn yesterday in hopes of inducing Flynn to offer additional cooperation on the Russia probe. Well, a federal judge in Washington yesterday postponed sentencing for President Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, but not before giving him a scolding. Flynn pleaded guilty last year to lying to investigators with the Russia probe led by special counsel Robert Mueller. Flynn is being given more time to cooperate, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone in Washington.
For former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, it was judgment delayed. A federal judge put off a final decision on sentencing Flynn to give the retired Army general more time to cooperate with the Russia investigation led by special counsel Robert Mueller. But Judge Emmett Sullivan also told Flynn that he could not hide his disgust for what Flynn had done, adding that arguably you sold your country out. Flynn pleaded guilty last year to lying to FBI agents about his contacts with Russia's former ambassador to the U.S. during the presidential transition period. Prosecutors had said previously that Flynn has been cooperative and recommended no jail time for the retired general. White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders was asked about Flynn's situation.
The delay is something between General Flynn and the courts, and that's something for them to determine what that timeline looks like. In the meantime, we wish General Flynn well, and we'll continue to focus on doing what we do here every single day.
President Trump wished Flynn luck in a tweet and once again denied any collusion between his 2016 campaign and Russia, the focus of the special counsel probe. Flynn's assistance in the Russia investigation appears to be considerable, says analyst Chris Edelson.
I think it's pretty clear Michael Flynn did have a story to tell and does have a story to tell and has told that story to the special counsel in apparently 19 different meetings. So there's a lot there. It may involve obstruction of justice. It may involve cooperation between Russia and the Trump campaign.
Flynn's court appearance came less than a week after President Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, was sentenced to 3 years in jail. Cohen pleaded guilty to charges including campaign finance violations related to payments for two women to keep them from talking about alleged affairs with Trump before he became president. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
While the International Committee of the Red Cross reports complex preparations are underway for a mass prisoner exchange between the Saudi-backed government in Yemen and Houthi rebels toward the end of next month, Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
Yemen's warring parties exchanged lists of prisoners during the peace talks earlier last week in Sweden. Each list contains the names of 8,000 detainees they are willing to release. The International Committee of the Red Cross says the parties have 40 days from December 11th, when the agreement was signed, to check the accuracy of the names of prisoners on the lists. It notes some of the people named might already have been released or are missing. After that process is completed, ICRC Regional Director for the Near and Middle East, Fabrizio Carboni, says the Red Cross will have 10 days before the release takes place. During this time, Red Cross delegates will interview the detainees to make sure they want to go back to their places of origin.
And after there is the logistic of taking people from one place to another, we'll have a plane. We need to secure the place where the plane will land. We need to make sure that all the parties involved in the conflict guarantee the security of the operation. It's going to be a long one, an intense one. No doubt that there will be hiccups.
Carboni says unpredictable situations always arise. He says the Red Cross will be ready to deal with unforeseen events. He tells VOA the prisoner exchange will occur simultaneously. He says the ICRC is solely in charge of the operation, including the covering of all costs.
Here we are playing what we call the neutral intermediary role of the ICRC. And our experience is the best way to make things happen is that you take responsibility for everything and you ask for money to nobody.
Carboni says many people have gone missing in the war. He says their families will be hoping to see the names of their loved ones among the list of detainees. He says the most difficult part of this operation will be seeing the pain of those whose last hope of finding their missing loved ones alive is crushed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, the White House signaled today it would consider a stopgap spending plan to avert a partial government shutdown at midnight Friday and extend funding into the early weeks of 2019. Kellyanne Conway, an advisor to President Donald Trump, said the U.S. leader could possibly support legislation being drafted in Congress that would keep the government open until February 8th. She said he would take a look at that, certainly. 2 days ahead of the shutdown threat that could close a quarter of U.S. government operations, the White House and lawmakers have yet to reach an agreement. Trump last week said he would proudly own a shutdown in order to get $5 billion in funding for construction of a wall along the 3,200-kilometer U.S. border with Mexico to thwart illegal immigration. But without enough votes in Congress, Trump retreated yesterday, with the White House saying it would look for other ways to secure funding by trying to tap unused money from several federal agencies. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. While one of the most common birth defects throughout the world is a cleft lip, babies born with a cleft lip may also have a cleft palate where the roof of the mouth is split. These birth defects can be repaired surgically, but unless that is done, it can result in significant disabilities and even death. More from VOA's Carol Pearson.
Before Daniel Trulio was born, an ultrasound showed Daniel had a cleft lip and a cleft palate. That's when Dr. Albert O at Children's National Medical Center started planning Daniel's surgery. O says the ultrasound shows how severe a cleft is.
You can also tell in terms of whether it's one-sided or both-sided, and it also gives you a chance to look for other potential associated problems that these babies can have.
Daniel was also born with a small jaw, a complication that can accompany a cleft palate or lip. Doctors created a hole from the front of his neck into his windpipe so Daniel could breathe. The procedure is called a tracheostomy, or trach for short. 9 in 10 children with a cleft lip or cleft palate can die without surgery, according to Dr. William McGee. McGee founded Operation Smile to repair cleft lips and palates more than 35 years ago. He spoke via Skype.
More people die every year in our world from lack of access to surgery than die from malaria, AIDS, and TB combined.
Operation Smile and similar charities teach repair techniques to doctors in developing countries. Also, McGee says Operation Smile is heavily involved in research.
We know that there's a genetic effect to it, and we have now the largest collection of genetic specimens in the world.
3 siblings provided the clue for the gene that causes this condition. Dr. Chai explained his research in a Skype interview.
Normally, you would only see one child in a family of 3 or 4 children that developed this birth defect.
A genetic mutation accounts for only about a third of the cases, so scientists are still searching for other causes. As for Daniel, he had his cleft palate fixed in May of 2017. He needs more surgeries to extend his jaw and fix his teeth, but there's a world of difference between the baby he was then and the toddler he is today. Robin Trulio, Daniel's mother, reflects on these changes.
He was getting sick a lot, frequent colds, and he got pneumonia a few times. He needed a lot more care. He needed a lot of suctioning through his trach. He was in the hospital a couple times, but like right now, he doesn't get sick. If he does, it's resolved quickly. He's definitely living a happy, healthy life.
Daniel can now breathe on his own. He's a happy toddler, and he's doing many of the things a 2-year-old normally does. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Greencastle, Pennsylvania.
And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us.
Hello and welcome to Africa.